Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU.
This week, Setlist live at the Great Escape. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt, and this week is a special edition of the show live at the Great Escape in Brighton. It's Saturday. We've been here for, it feels like most of time.
But it's been a good time.
But I just want to preface it because my voice has dropped about 3 octaves. It's Saturday. It was a late night. Anyway, as ever, we're going to take a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. And that was a week when I feel like because it's relevant, we should start off by talking about the session we did on Thursday to kick off the Music and Data Strand, because I'm a recording artist now.
It's true. I'm Chris Cook, by the way, because he hasn't introduced me to people listening to the podcast.
Should we do introductions first and then we'll discuss? Let's do introductions first.
Good.
With me is Chris Cook.
Hello.
And also my two excellent guests if you could both introduce yourselves.
Shall I go first? As I'm sitting beside you.
Who are you?
I am Becky Brook. I advise music and tech companies about music and tech. So usually if it's a music company, I advise them about tech. And if it's a tech company, I advise them about music. This is my second set list.
It is.
So I feel really quite privileged.
Yes, a returning co-host.
Am I the first returning?
Well, to put that in context, in the 87 years we've been doing this podcast, I think we've had about 2 guests on the normal format and a previous live edition with 4 guests. And Becky's now been on twice.
So that is statistically very unusual.
Andy used to get quite annoyed how many people used to... The edition when we last had Becky on this podcast, Andy was off, and that was why I had Becky on. And people always used to tell Andy how that was such a good edition of the podcast.
It was the most... It's not anymore, but for quite a long time, it was the most popular edition of
really?
The show.
Really? Yes. Wow. Okay, amazing.
By some margin.
It was just me ranting about how dysfunctional US publishing is.
Yeah,
meanwhile,
like that.
Here we are.
It's all fixed.
so that's but not returning. First time appearing on Setlist. Amina, who are you? What do you do?
So my name is Amina Badley. I've lost my voice sorry. It was Thames show last night. It just really messed up my voice, but it's fine. So I'm Amina Badley. I am just stepped out of music management and I am fully now a video producer. I do like content, marketing, bit of PR. Just a creative entrepreneur. That's what I want to be called. Creative entrepreneur. That's it. Yeah.
That's a good title. I want to be that.
Yeah. Come on.
Great. Well, now let's get back to... well done for remembering that we should introduce people. I signed to your record label the other day.
Yes. So at this year's Great Escape, we had a whole day on music and data. Because I'm interested in data. It was a pretty full room. So
I think a lot of people are interested in music and data, it turns out.
It turns out just as well. And so in order to explain to people how rights and track data works, obviously it's really important. Track data is really important for getting music played and then the rights data for getting artists paid. And so we released a track and then followed it on its data journey. And the track was the Setlist jingle that you heard at the start of this edition, stretched out to 4.5 minutes.
Well, 3.5, but yeah. I mean, that was a weird... I mean, we thought that would be funny to release a 3-minute version of a jingle, but it was weird. A thing that I wrote as a 9-second jingle, turning that into a 3-minute song was...
Was it just the same 9 seconds over and...
I saw
the presentation. Okay, so you didn't just go 9 seconds over and over and over again for 3 minutes.
No, that would... That's a good idea. I should have done that.
It would have been a lot quicker.
It would have been. I spent so much time on it.
Sorry, maybe I underestimated you there. Apologies.
So Andy did create our jingle way back in the day.
Mm.
If you originally on our podcast, the CMU podcast, before it became Setlist, we had a jingle that I got off some terrible audio download site that he hated for years. And then he moaned about it. And in the end, I said, well, you make something better. And that was the Setlist theme tune. It's now a 3-minute track that you can go and stream. We've released it. And I signed him to my label, CMU Records, which didn't exist previously, but it does now exist. We've signed Andy. It was a 5-year 50-50 profit share deal. I'm a very ethical label. Becky doesn't think.
I mean, you also cut yourself in as a co-writer on the song. I know, I'm not sure how ethical that is.
Well, this does not sound ethical to me.
I organized a launch party at the Great Escape on stage in front of a room full of people for this track. So that's quite an investment on my part. So yes, and then on the publishing side, this is the first track in history where we wanted the rights to be more complicated. So it's like, how can we get co-ownership? Because otherwise it's not going to work.
Excuses for stealing some of Andy's copyright.
Well, so we put some edited highlights from the podcast in the track, which therefore means I'm a lyricist now. Okay. And so I took 25% of the publishing. The track is still unpublished, by the way. Anyone listening would like the publishing rights? Yeah,
you said that several times on stage.
You offered them to Laura May, right?
I did, on
May
stage.
May Music, and she was like,
So still looking for a publishing deal, if anyone is...
So we released the track, and then we followed it on its data journey, and we explained why data's so important, track data, metadata, etc. But then all the rights data, and the performers, and the writers, and if you screw the data up, you don't get paid... Actually, sometimes you can get the data right and you still don't get paid. More of which later, I think, because we're not actually here to talk about Andy Malt being a pop star.
No, it's just I just wanted to tell everyone. The track is now available on all the streaming services. So I'll stick a link in the show notes because we can make that
under the
sweet
artist
streaming
name,
money.
Set list without the vowels, because yeah. Vowels are out of fashion, aren't they, with cutting edge musicians.
Yeah, we picked a name that would, if I was press released... that would be the name that would annoy me the most. So that was why I chose it.
Set list all capitals, even though CMU House style is that we ignore all capital artist names.
So all capitals, no vowels.
All capitals, no vowels. Slst.
Okay.
Slst.
That sounds like a medical condition.
And anyway, we're not here to talk
about
this.
We're not here to talk about this because later on we'll be discussing the MMF's new song royalties manifesto and the death of the iPod. But first, it was announced a few days ago that Napster, if anyone remembers that, had been acquired by a consortium of investors led by the crypto-focused investment firm Hivemind and blockchain company Algorand. It's not actually completely clear what the plan is, but we do know that the brand is going to be used for some Web3 stuff, because everyone likes Web3 stuff. This also follows the recent announcement that the LimeWire name is being used for an NFT marketplace. That's a project that Hivemind is also involved with. It's the revival of all these.
It's kind of funny that the music NFT battle might end up between Napster and LimeWire.
The music industry will be like seething.
Well, I also think it suggests that all the music NFT startups are being run by people of a certain age.
Yeah, 40 plus.
For whom Napster and LimeWire, or Napster in particular,
is the height of music.
Yeah. Should we do a quick recap of Napster for our younger listeners who may not even know what Napster is?
Yeah, because that happens now. It's depressing. People don't know what Napster is.
Actually, I'm wondering how many people in this room were even born when Napster was big. Napster really peaked in 2001, right?
They got shut down in 2001, yeah.
2000 maybe was its peak. Sorry.
So, Mina, what when you were a teenager, what was your piracy platform of choice?
Literally LimeWire. That was
LimeWire generation.
Everything I got... you know what? We used to try and download songs, and unfortunately, other things that we can't mention would come up. Unfortunately,
that was the music industry pushing them in,
pushing certain things in. But LimeWire was my thing. We used to get download music, shows, films, and that made me cool.
So Kick-Ass was my piracy platform of choice when I was young.
I forgot all about Kick-Ass.
See, that came after the whole BitTorrent stuff.
What year was Kick-Ass?
Well, the whole BitTorrent thing was a bit later,
yes.
Wasn't it?
Yeah,
So Pirate Bay was really buzzy, I'd say, about 2008, 2009, and then Kick-Ass came
even
next,
later.
And then Kick-Ass got shut down, so yeah.
So you were very late to the piracy game.
I'm just very young.
I feel like we must be at least the same age, so I think that's not true.
So Napster, I guess, was the first of the P2P file sharing platforms that really grabbed global attention and made the music industry aware, oh my God, something really bad is happening online and all the kids are downloading all of our music and sharing all of our music without license. That's copyright infringement. And it was the first, certainly I think it was the first one to actually be sued. Certainly, it was the first big lawsuit involving a file-sharing service, all in the US. And this is like, it actually all happened really fast. But at the time, it felt like it was dragging out. And so they got sued for the US courts. I think initially, there was a bit of a wobble on, does this even constitute piracy? There was a thing called the Betamax defense, which all went back to the 1980s, where Napster would say, well, we're just a digital equivalent of a video recorder. Sony Betamax were not liable when people used their Betamax videos to pirate, so we shouldn't be liable either. And then the court said, well, Napster actually had a central database. It was quite unusual. Most P2P file sharing networks didn't, but Napster did. So they said, well, you've got a central database. So actually, you know what music is being shared. Whereas Sony Betamax didn't know when people were using their video players to infringe copyright. So Napster lost. They went bankrupt. The old BMG, the original BMG major record company, actually was the one major which were like, actually, maybe we should be talking to these people. Maybe these guys are onto something. And they tried to invest. So then the other majors sued BMG. and then Napster was gone. It was bankrupt. But the brand then went up for sale through bankruptcy. And then a company called Roxio bought it. I never really understood because they were they a CD burning company or something? Anyway.
I mean, I was around at that time, but it was very early days. I remember them doing CD burning, but I don't really remember.
Ultimately, it ended up with a company who then launched it as a download store. So this was around about the time the iTunes store was launching, and they were like, oh, well, Napster's the big brand that everyone loves, so Napster will become the download store of choice, and nobody used it. mainly because by this point, the iPod was on the market. More on that later.
More on that later, yes.
And Napster was selling music, I think, using Microsoft's Windows Media. I mean, they all were in those days, apart from iTunes.
Yeah, it was like the OD2 powered stores as well, wasn't it? You had the Microsoft Windows Media Store. I subscribed to it. It was £15 a month for, I think it was like 200 limited downloads.
Yeah,
so it's basically Spotify, but much, much more expensive and much crapper.
And a different model to iTunes, crucially. So whereas iTunes was a pound down, initially it was 80p a download, I think. Yeah. Whereas with Napster, it was a subscription download store.
But it wasn't all you could eat.
Wasn't all you could eat using Windows technology that nobody could play because everyone was buying iPods and iPods wouldn't play Windows Media Files. And then it sort of slowly morphed into a streaming. Whilst everyone was talking about streaming, they reinvented themselves as a streaming service and said, oh, we were always a subscription streaming service. And it's like, no, you were.
They were subscription.
They just weren't.
It was subscription download. It was the download part of the existing subscription services we have now, right?
Offline listening.
Exactly.
Yeah. And they got bought by Best Buy, one of the big retailers in the US. And then they merged with a company called Rhapsody, which was genuinely one of the early streaming services in the US. And then it was interesting when Rhapsody bought them because they decided to keep the Napster name in the rest of the world because they said, well, it's got big brand recognition. Why would we give it up? And it's like, you do realize that nobody still knows Napster exists.
That's what to say.
Yeah, as a streaming service, everyone's forgotten. People still think of file sharing. And then last year, was it that Melody VR bought it?
Yeah. Yeah. It was about...
2020?
Was it 2020? It was, yeah, maybe it was like 18 months ago. Yeah, I think it was about 18 months ago.
So Melody VR was, a few years ago, everyone got very excited about virtual reality and the potential in music. And I mean, I suppose that's kind of morphing into the metaverse conversation now. But Melody VR bought Napster, which was kind of weird, actually, because it was one of those where it felt like they were buying a much bigger company, even though I've just said that no one remembered it existed and they got 72 subscribers.
But Napster, I mean, it was surprising to everyone, but Napster 2 years ago still was a meaningful entity in the music industry, right? They were running B2B services and direct to consumer services, and so they still had, at least in the music industry, on the business side, they had a profile. Like they were established business that had revenues. I mean, not substantial revenues and maybe not profitable, but still revenues.
Yeah, and they had done some good mobile partnerships in some markets, and as you say, they had the B2B bit where they were powering other people's streaming services,
other big blue chip company music services. But as someone who's worked on blue chip companies music services, that's not generally a good business.
And then once Melody VR had bought them, Melody VR rebranded as Napster, and they were like, okay, we're going to bring together streaming and virtual reality, and we're going to have the future of streaming. And then they all went a bit quiet, and now they've been bought.
Yes, yeah, they hired someone as a chief strategy officer. And now we know what the strategy is. It was sell it, and she's now CEO. So that's the strategy.
But this was kind of predictable, right? Like, if you looked at their financial filings, I think the last filing they did, they basically said, we've got 25 million and we spend 25 million a year, something to that effect. I mean, don't give me the exact numbers. It was 20 something and 20 something. Basically, they were showing that they were burning money very, very fast. I mean, to be burning a million or two a month, that's a really high burn rate. Like, that's a lot of cash you have to generate. And so I think it was quite obvious that something would have to change very, very quickly, because they were clearly kind of out of money because they'd not announced a new fundraise recently. So it was, they were either going to disappear or be acquired in the next few months. It'd been predictable for about a year.
I guess when we said, see, the fact that it's old file sharing brands being, you know, bought up and placed on Web3 stuff, it's like that clearly says something about the people who are involved in these projects. But what is the benefit of badging these projects with old file sharing brands?
I mean,
is there a benefit? I mean, it's supposed to be shiny new Web3 stuff.
Well, do you think, all exciting, both of you on this, is it that NFT platforms are trying to position themselves as being the agitators, the disruptors? We're edgy, we're doing something new, and they want brands which back in the day were the disruptors, but except with the distinction of we're not illegal, I guess.
I think for me, I feel like, you know, with NFTs, I think they just, NFT companies in general, because it's not new, but it's not, I think there's a bit of, not confusion, but a bit of, not mistrust, I think I would say mistrust with NFT brands. So I think collaborating with brands that are, you know, that are more namely, that have stronger names, they probably feel that it kind of solidifies what they're doing. But for me personally, I'm not really an NFT.
But you've just said you were a big LimeWire user back in the day.
Yeah.
So does that attract you?
I feel like I follow the trends. Like, I follow whatever's like the new naughty. Like, whatever's naughty and new, I feel like I follow that. So it depends on how they build their brand. So yeah, that's for me. Yeah.
I should confess that I have, in between the time I was last on, Setlist, and now I have spent a lot of time working on music and blockchain. So, like, and when I started doing that, really about the time I was on Setlist last time around, 4.5 years ago, I was very, very skeptical about blockchain in all forms. And I became convinced that it had an application, and that application was really focused around music and rights. And I won't dive into that in more detail, but at that time, those really early music blockchain companies were mostly saying, I'm not allowed to swear, am I?
You can swear.
Oh, you can swear.
Well, they were basically just saying, like, this is all fucked. We're going to build a parallel universe where it all works. And it was always really rather misguided, but they weren't trying to, they were talking to the music industry, but they weren't really trying to mostly engage with them constructively. Mostly that early generation were just like, it's very broken. The way to fix it is to build a parallel universe, which I think is completely, the point about it being broken might be valid, but the point about it building a parallel universe is mistaken. This generation, crypto has, well, it had done really well until quite recently over the last few years. And so suddenly it's awash with money. And
by which you mean the cryptocurrencies?
The cryptocurrencies had done really well in the last few years. And I think that they were awash with money, and they were trying to your point, they were trying to legitimize their brands. And it was quite easy to pick up things like LimeWire and Napster for a relatively bargainous price. They couldn't buy Spotify without, you know, without billions in their hand.
Although fewer billions now than 6 months ago.
Yes, but still like many billions. Whereas
we've still got our share, and we would ask for a lot.
But like, yeah, we'd be the holdouts.
Do we know what price they paid for Napster?
I don't know, because I've been at the Great Escape and I wasn't paying attention. Andy, did you take note?
So, no, because the statement was a very brief statement. We don't actually know what they're doing.
There wasn't even an official statement, was it? It was LinkedIn.
Yeah, just a thing on LinkedIn. There's not a lot of detail on what they're doing. And we know more about the LimeWire thing, which, as I say, Hivemind is also involved in that in a lesser capacity. But like that project, the LimeWire project, the idea is that it's bringing NFTs to a more mainstream audience. It's going to overcome some of the barriers, and I think, you know, make it so you can buy in dollars rather than crypto. I mean, whether that's actually
you didn't LimeWire to do that, though, right?
Well, no, I don't.
sorry, I mean, there's plenty of people who've enabled you to buy crypto assets with dollars for a long time. That technology's existed for a
long
time.
But I suppose their shtick was, aside from, oh, LimeWire's exciting, well, it was very much positioned as LimeWire's coming back. And it's like, it really isn't. You've just bought the brand.
Yeah, the name, basically, yeah. Right?
But then they were saying, okay, the opportunity here is the average music fan can't get their head around NFTs. We're going to have the super user-friendly site. You don't need to understand crypto, but you're shaking your head and saying that's already been done. We don't need that.
I don't know. It all just seems a bit misplaced to me. Like, these are brands as which we discussed. The average person under 40 doesn't know what this brand is. Like, neither Napster or LimeWire are relevant to the young generation, who are, let's be frank, the ones who are most actively adopting digital assets.
Literally.
Right?
I was just about to say, to me, it just seems like there's no disrespect, but I feel like it's just a bunch of people in a room with a lot of money and random ideas and just thinking, let's just connect all this together, because it actually doesn't make sense, in my opinion. Like, I feel like it's even the brands like Napster and LimeWire, like the younger generation, I'm not going to say my generation, I'm not that young, but I feel like, as you just said, the younger generation, they're not, how can I explain that? Because we are kind of led by trends and things that are popular, something like Napster and LimeWire and all these names that were kind of cool, but not really cool in my day, to the new generation, unless it's something like Spotify or Apple or just these new kind of names that people understand, I don't think it connects, in my opinion. Mm. So whoever's the heads of these companies, I think, yeah, if we need to chat. In my opinion.
I don't think that's disrespectful. I think you said you didn't want to disrespect them, but I think that's a fair summary of the situation.
Nothing against them, but you know. Yeah.
It's not personal, though.
Yeah, it's not personal.
It is business. You can call a spade a spade.
You know what it is? I just think that sometimes I get like the innovative kind of ideas, and a lot of heads of companies that have these, you know, they bring in heads of marketing or heads of brand and they have these cool ideas, but in actuality, it doesn't really land. So I hopefully this one works, but I don't think it will. But hopefully it will.
I suppose another quick question to ask both of you. I mean, the whole music NFTs thing, we had a couple of sessions on NFT and also Metaverse here this year. I mean, do you think there is an opportunity in this space, whether it's the digital collectible or whether it is a way to make, you know, raise money to fund recordings and then give people a royalty right, or whether it's a fan club that where the token is your membership card? All these different products are being proposed. Clearly, there's a lot of hype and there's a lot of businesses that are going to go nowhere. And there's a lot of cryptocurrency being speculated on this, because cryptocurrency always feels like it's not real money. Mm. But do you think out of all of this, some interesting new businesses that quite a lot of music fans and artists will engage with are going to come out?
Well, I'll be honest. The artist that I was working with, I did, one of the things that we was kind of pushing him into was crypto. It is the future. Like, I definitely know that. It definitely is the future. I may not understand it all, but I know that it has... when it comes to music and where it could go and creating your own characters and creating your own world, like, realistically, within the next 5 years, I do think we will potentially be living in this world, you know, in this...
And I guess what you're alluding to there is, I think NFTs and Metaverse actually kind of feel like they belong together.
Yes, literally.
And that they both make more sense
together
with the other two.
Yeah.
And almost it's like... how will Meta, Google and Apple come and screw all this up? But I think I agree, yes. Despite... Andy Malt at the end there is quite cynical about NFTs. Are you still quite cynical about NFTs?
I've sat through our sessions on NFTs and I wouldn't...
Enjoyed engaging with
our wouldn't
sessions.
Say I'm entirely sold on the idea, but I can definitely see some of the opportunities in that area, and particularly like we discussed before, like the kind of direct-to-fan stuff and, you know... Providing digital collectibles is something that people want.
Yeah.
And I think that there are exciting things happening. I think, but a lot of it is just sort of, I don't know, people throwing stuff at the wall and it being a bit nonsense, like buying Napster.
Becky, you mentioned that you have spent a lot of time on blockchain initiatives and how they might work in music, initially around fixing some of the music rights data problems. So do you think there are definite opportunities here, and how quickly will we figure out what the actual long-term opportunities are?
So I do believe that that there's a potential that blockchain and NFTs will enable us to recreate scarcity in a way that the music industry has really struggled with for the last 20 years since it migrated to digital. You know, when, and obviously, actually, one of the key things about resurgence in vinyl was the fact people are now subscribing to Spotify and then buying vinyl for their scarcity and for their physical product. I do believe that NFTs have the potential to create digital scarcity to some degree.
Perceived scarcity, often.
But that's the thing. I don't think it's going to be, I have an NFT and it's got a song in it and only I can listen to that song, because as soon as someone plays it, someone else in the room could just record it and then release it. Like, it's onto piracy sites, for example. And we know that once you, like, you look at what happened when Tidal first launched and it had all this exclusive music. Basically, what happened is piracy went rampant. Like, I think we as consumers have got so used to music being everywhere and available to everyone. People would not accept, you know, Kanye West's new song being allowed, being accessible to only one person.
It was only accessible to people who got his
thing. Yeah. But I would imagine that piracy's gone rampant around Donda as well.
We got that. You did.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost a certainty. It's like consumers, the cat is out of the bag. Consumers have, for at least 10 or 15 years and probably 20 years, have assumed that music is like water, it's everywhere. And so there's no point trying to make music, like songs, scarce. But potentially there's things which are like experiences, like sign-offs from your favourite artist, or like private notes and stuff like that. You know, there's things you could do that are like more like fan club like elements, which could potentially be interesting. I should say, as a consumer myself, it's lost on me, but then I am nearly 40, so I'm not the perfect audience. I grew up in an age where the digital kind of revolution was just starting, and I was really on the cusp of it. I loved it, but I'm really late to the you know, digital collectibles game. It's just not for me. If I want something to be collectible, then I want it to be able to feel it and stroke it. I love buying my vinyl, and you know, even if I very rarely play it, and I mostly use Spotify, I still love having my record player there with all my vinyl. So I believe there's a potential there. Also, not least because people like me in 20 years' time will be ancient, and and we will be the minority of the society, right? And so things are changing, and I do think NFTs, digital collectibles, will be really quite impactful in the future, but it's probably maybe not necessarily for me as an audience.
With the whole digital collectibles thing, it's when you watch what's happening in Fortnite and the kids play Fortnite,
say that,
suddenly
literally.
It's like, it's no interest to me. Yes. But look at
this. I think even when Travis Scott done the Fortnite takeover, for me, I don't even care about Fortnite. I literally have no care, but that I wanted to be part of that experience. And I think that it's the selling the experience, selling the kind of, obviously we can't have the physical product in the whole NFT thing, but I feel like the experience of that, like missing that moment, because I felt, well, I missed it, I missed the moment, but it was a big moment and it was across the world, and
and then the skins and the emotes and all the stuff that they sell around it, which I say, zero interest to me, but clearly a lot of people want it.
But that's exactly it. Like, the younger generation, the ones who don't know what Napster and LimeWire are, these things are interesting. These digital collectibles do have real value to the average 10-year-old, because they grew up in a world where they've always had digital. Digital's always been a thing. They don't see the distinction like us oldies do. So absolutely, I talked to a friend of mine about this who used to work in our industry and is super amazingly intelligent. And she was like, I just don't see it. And I said to her, but your boys, they love digital assets. Mm. You know, Roblox is amazing for them.
Yeah, my daughter.
And I was like,
same.
And this is the future. And so I think we should have got someone younger on this panel, I think. Because they would tell us that we're all ancient and this stuff's amazing. But to the other point, so if we think collectibles, there's definitely an opportunity there, right? How big it is will depend on, like, whether people can create something that's genuinely compelling to collect. We don't know, right? Like, people are investing, like Warner investing heavily. But the interesting thing about the investing in royalties, investing in microfinancing for music, I think that's so interesting. But if we talk next about the black box, investing in song rights or work rights, there's no point investing in it until the pipes are working, because there's no way to get any money back out, because it's hard enough to get paid as a normal songwriter. Investing in song rights on an NFT, like the early NFTs around song rights, they were so, I don't want to use the word dodgy, but I'll say it. They looked dodgy to me, because they were like, you'll get a royalty. Okay, well, no, you won't, because there's no way to guarantee you'll get the money back out of it. Like, it was literally like, when you read the fan terms and conditions, it just said, well, the artist will have, you know, to give us their reporting and tell us how much money they earn and then give us some of their money. And it was like, yeah, that's never going to happen.
I suppose on the recording side, particularly obviously because Ditto are involved in an NFT platform, they're doing the distribution, and recording royalties are just so much easier.
You're
still trusting the platform to continue to pay you.
But it's possible, yeah. There's nothing stopping plugging in a system where you could split the royalties out of the royalty distribution systems for recording and pay out 10% commission or something. Yeah, of course you could. Whether you will, that's another question. I think a lot of these things are still really lacking in accountability and transparency.
Yeah.
But I think that's very possible. In the next few years, we'll probably see some really interesting kind of microfinancing and or investing in recording assets. But I wouldn't put any money into musical works on NFTs at this stage, because it has to rely on the existing systems, and the existing systems don't work well enough.
We had a guy called Dez who does a lot of consulting around NFTs on our panel on Thursday, and I've chatted to him about this, and he thinks that the whole getting a royalty right in a track will work at scale, because what he sort of sees is there'll be a community of people who basically play A&R as a game. And if there's a platform where you can invest in 200 tracks at any one time, and you go through and you pretend you're an A&R person and you put money in 20 of them, we all know that most of them you're going to get a dollar back. But maybe you get the one where you get the hit, and maybe if you can game it like that. But at the moment, a lot of these platforms have one artist at a time, which means it's really a super fan game, isn't it? It's just...
I mean, you're describing something like almost like a fantasy football kind of thing, aren't you?
I guess.
But it's all great in theory, but we're always trying to gamify every single experience because we believe that that's what's going to make it compelling. And I don't know, I can't... That sounds like a very, very leaned-in experience and relatively niche to me. Maybe I'm wrong because I'm not 15, but it doesn't appeal to me.
Anyway, I suspect, given that the next topic is something that me and Becky can talk for about 82 days.
I was going to say, yes, we should move on. And you did just reference the songwrites. And so our second story this week was that on Friday at The Great Escape.
Thursday.
Was it Thursday? On Thursday at The Great Escape, which is where we are now. Yeah. The Music Managers Forum launched the Song Royalties Manifesto, which sets out a three-step proposal to overhaul how royalties are paid out to songwriters and composers and make a fairer system for those, artists, I guess. You know, the more behind-the-scenes, not recording artists.
Songwriters.
I said it already. Yeah. I was trying to find a way to finish that sentence and I wasn't managing it. Songwriters, yeah.
So we've talked about all of this endlessly on Setlist. So regulars of this podcast will know what we're talking about. So this is all about the way that the song side of the business processes royalties when music is streamed. We kind of alluded to it there with what Becky was saying about some NFT platforms on the recording side. Labels and distributors have deals with streaming services. They upload their recordings. The recordings get streamed. There's a slightly complicated system by which royalties are calculated, but crucially, Spotify can run that system itself, and it works out where everybody's due under their deals, and it pays them, and everyone's happy, and that's fine. But in the recording, there's a song, separate copyright. Labels and distributors don't own or control those rights. They can't issue a license for those rights. And so we have a whole separate system for paying songwriters. And basically, Spotify doesn't know what songs are on its platform. Knows what recordings are on its platform. It knows what the recordings are called, but lots of tracks have the same name. And so it doesn't know what songs are streaming, let alone who owns the copyright in those songs. So the current system works like this, and Becky can correct me if I get any of this wrong. At the end of the month, Spotify sends to all of its licensing partners on the song side, which is a combination of music publishers and collecting societies and then agents they employ, a spreadsheet of every single track that was streamed in each market in the previous month, identified by recording. So the ISRC, which is our unique identifier for recordings, billions of lines of data. And then it's the job of the publishers and societies to go through, identify the songs that are, well, where there are recordings that contain their songs that they control, and then report that back. Song copyrights are often co-owned, so they might actually have 62%, 33%. There's the added complication that when a song streams, both the mechanical rights and the performing rights of the song are exploited. If you don't know what that means, go and find a past podcast where we explained it. And sometimes one entity licenses the mechanical rights, one entity licenses the performing rights. And so every month, this massive spreadsheet comes in. Everyone has to go through, claim the money. And sometimes they get it right, sometimes they get it wrong, sometimes nobody knows what song is in a recording, sometimes we don't know who owns it, sometimes we've got 150% of the copyright being owned, well, that can't be right. And it basically means a number of things. First of all, it takes a lot longer to get songwriters paid because it all takes time. So whereas artists, you know, can be paid within 2 months of stream where the system's working, I mean, 6 months is probably good on the song side.
If you're very lucky, in my experience.
And it can take years.
Well, also because at least to my experience, it's not actually done monthly, it's done quarterly. So if someone streams in January, often the report comes out in April. And to be fair, I will give the CMO's credit or the processing hub's credit. They do want those reports by April or at latest, like, you know, within 60 or 90 days at absolute worst. But then it's the process, what happens after you've given them a report. If you're a DSP, you've given them every single song that's played in Europe by service type, by paid or free, by territory. So like that's, you know, as you said, it's like if you're talking about tens of millions of songs times multiple, like 30 something countries in, well, I don't know, depending on how many countries in Europe you're in, times the number of offerings, free and paid or free, family paid, duo. You know, you get the idea. It's like it becomes, as you said, billions of lines of data. And then if you're a very, very big platform, like the Apples or Spotify's, you might get a claim from them, from the hubs on behalf of the publishers and the CMOs within a few months. But if you're a medium-sized platform, then you will get it within a few years. And if you're a small platform, you'll never get it.
Oh, Lord.
So if it's a royalty from the Apples or the Spotify's, that's the best chance you're going to have of seeing it the quickest because the claim might go in. I mean, my understanding I've heard anecdotally is that most of the claims will go in within the first 6 months. But that's still like a long timeline because it means the songwriters aren't going to be paid until probably nine months later.
Yeah, because often the societies or publishers who ultimately get the money once it's all been claimed are probably then only paying out quarterly at best in many cases.
Yeah, exactly. So it's often a quarterly process. It's a quarterly reporting process, then a quarterly matching process, and then another quarter to pay out. So you 6 months if you're lucky, 9 months if you're still quite lucky, and you know years later if you're not.
And in addition to the time lag, then there's the issues of where we don't match and we don't know what to do with the money, or where there's overclaims or underclaims. And if there's a data dispute, sometimes that means all payments just stop. But often half the songwriters don't even know that's happening. So they're actually getting nothing and it can take a long time to work out why aren't we getting any money. There's a data dispute in the system.
Or if your usage is not so high that you meet the threshold levels. And I think that's, as far as I'm concerned, and I was quite aggressive about it on Thursday. I might have been told I was slightly aggressive. If your song, I haven't been able to find a public statement about what those thresholds are from any of the processing hubs or any of the societies, but even if each line has to be worth more than £1, for example, that adds up quite quickly because we talked about the fact that every line is a service tier in a territory for a song. And so you can have hundreds of lines in a quarter or a month, but each line might only be worth 50p. But you don't get any of that if each line is under the threshold.
So just to clarify on that, because Becky's very, very big on this. And actually, in terms of the work that obviously CMU has done, the music management form on this over the years, this isn't something we've been big on. We are now because Becky's telling us to. So there are all these links in the chain and there are different agents and stuff. And some of those links in the chain will say, okay, well, if we don't get more than this, we don't pass the money on. But crucially, sometimes when you have those thresholds, like in digital distribution, a lot of digital distributors will say, we're not going to send you any money until you've got 50 quid because it's not worth our while. Well, but crucially,
the cost of paying you is more than the money we're sending you sometimes.
Yeah. But crucially, the money builds and it sits there. And even if it takes 6 years, when you get to the threshold, you're paid. Whereas on the song side, some of these thresholds, if you don't meet the threshold in the month or the quarter or the year, then it's wiped clean. And you start at zero in the next period. And so money's not getting through. And then the last thing is there's a cost to administrating all of this. And even where you've got the best societies and the best processing people, most of which I think are probably in Europe, and even where they're all really good people doing really good work, then again, they have to charge for the work they're doing. And that can only come out of the royalties that are flowing through the system, which means the publishers and the writers are losing
out. Well, you say that, but actually in the US, the DSPs pay for it.
In the US, the DSPs pay for cost of the law.
But outside of North America for mechanicals. Yeah, no, you're right. Of course, it's always the songwriters pay a commission for the work that's done on their behalf. But let's be honest, that commission's very high. Like, and not to say that anyone's doing anything inappropriate in the sense that the commission reflects the cost of doing it, but maybe we should be doing it better.
And so we've talked about this endlessly on Setlist over the years, the Music Managers Forum at the last in-person Greatest Game in 2019, published a thing called the Song Royalties Guide, that explained everything that we've just said. And as of 2 days ago, this new Song Royalties Manifesto came along. And it actually, when the Song Royalties Guide was published, and obviously at CMU, we helped produce that, we found that we would go around the industry and say, this is how it works. It's mad, isn't it? And everyone would go, yeah, it's mad, isn't it? And they're like, well, what do we do with it? I don't know. It's just mad. and we sort of got to the point where it's like, well, actually, let's take a step back and say, how could we solve this? And actually, solving it's not as complicated as the system itself. I mean, it's a big ask. It's not to say that it's not a big ask and it's going to involve a lot of people doing a lot of stuff. But actually, I think the solution isn't that complex. So that's what the manifesto is about. And I think, Becky, because you actually presented this on stage at The Great Escape, it would be good for you to explain, first of all, that there's a government bit of this involved.
Okay. So, I mean, so as part of the IPO's...
That being the Intellectual Property Office.
Sorry. Yes. The UK's Intellectual Property Office is looking into the economics of streaming. And as part of that, they have two working groups. Chris, you're on one of them, aren't you?
I'm on the Transparency Working Group.
And I'm on the Metadata Working Group. And as part of that, the Metadata Working Group was asked, what would a well-functioning system look like? I should say, like, I got this question, I was like, yes, because this is exactly what we should be asking. Let's not say, oh, there's lots of problems and this is impossible to solve. Let's actually talk about what should it be like. And so MMF responded to, what should it look like? And so Chris, myself and Annabella kind of got together. And
Annabella being the CEO of MMF.
Apologies, yes. Annabella Coldrick being the CEO of MMF talked about, you know, what would a well-functioning system look like? And ultimately that means, and I don't think this should be really uncontroversial. Everyone who puts music out, who has music used and music that's then commercialized, should get paid for that use, right? That should be a really safest. It should. I'm not suggesting that you get paid 1p every one day. Like, that of course doesn't scale. But like, to Chris's point about thresholds, if you only get £20 in one quarter, that £20 should wait for you until you've got £60 or whatever the payment threshold is. It is unacceptable that we as an industry have got comfortable with grassroots songwriters and potentially even mid-range songwriters not getting their royalties simply because they've got hundreds of low-value lines that don't meet the administration threshold. And we do that because it's too expensive to process those lines. Well, then let's fix the system. Let's stop it being so expensive. And the reason it's so expensive is because, as Chris said, the process is really arduous. The fact that the DSPs send out a report every quarter and then tens of different entities, or at least 5 to 12 entities, all process that same data for matching purposes and then all submit claims between 2 weeks and 2 years later, sometimes 5 years later. And then the DSPs have to look at it and work out if that's a fair claim on a line-by-line basis. In practice, what that actually means is that it's way too burdensome. And that's why people don't get paid, because the cost of administering rights is far too high. Well, then let's fix that. Let's stop making excuses for not paying songwriters and pay them for their uses. It might be that they might have to wait a year for their money because they're only getting £10 a month, but then that's okay. Still, as long as they get their £120 at the end of the year. It's unacceptable to think that we will never give it to them. It's unacceptable to think, what happens to that money? And we know what happens. It goes to lots of things, including sometimes really good works. Like, it goes into things like schemes to train up young musicians. But that money should be coming from something else, not from the pockets of grassroots songwriters.
And so the manifesto says that there should be a new way of working, and we will put a link to where you can download it, because there isn't really time to go in for it in great detail. But it's things like, as soon as a song is written, the splits between the co-writers in terms of copyright ownership should be agreed. The ISWC, which is the identifier for the song, which sometimes can take months to come out of the system, sometimes it never comes out of the system, will be issued immediately, like within a day of the song being finished. All of this then should be put into a publicly accessible database. There should be data feeds coming out of publishers and societies of all of this information, so that we get to a point that when the recording is released, we can actually start to say to labels and distributors, not only should you identify the recording, you should identify the song. And that's reasonable to ask of labels and distributors, providing it's easy for them to to accurately find an ISWC?
I think the publishers, certainly the publishers, I don't think they're pushing back on the idea that we should start linking earlier. I think they all agree that that's a good idea. It's a bit of a no-brainer. I think where MMF is being more ambitious is suggesting...
It's the next step.
It's that final stage. It's suggesting that in the future, not now, 5, maybe 7, maybe even a few more years down the line, at some point in the future, music won't be released unless we fully understand who controls it. And that can change over time, but at least when it's released, people have made the effort to gather that data and enter it. And in the future, that means that songwriters could be paid within 2 months and things won't sit in black boxes.
And with lots of publicly accessible data about song ownership, Spotify could work it out itself.
Yeah,
what everybody is due, they'd still be paying licensing partners, publishers and societies, but that they would be able to work it out just like they do on the recording side. So it's all in the manifesto. I'm going to quickly, I mean, obviously, Mina, you mentioned at the start that you've just stepped away from management. But I think one of the reasons why it's interesting that the Music Managers Forum has led on this is, yes, it's making demands of collecting societies. It's making demands of the publishers and the labels and distributors. But it is also saying our community, which in the case of MMF is managers, we are going to take responsibility for that first bit.
I feel like, let me just clarify that. So I still am 1 foot in. Like I you know, my artist is my younger brother. So I will forever be involved in music management. And I am like not an entity in Brum, but I definitely, a lot of people don't understand the music industry. And through being through like part of the MMF and just being in the music industry for since 2017 or 2016, I've learned a lot about the other side of the music industry, how to make your money, how to get your royalties, how to get paid, because I've got so much people that don't understand that side and they've made songs. And I'm like, you can make money for this. Did you not know? I had an artist who, he had about 6 songs on YouTube. He had like over 15 million views on YouTube. I said, mate, you need to get the music onto Spotify and streaming platforms. Done that within the first year. Did he make 30 grand? I think he did. And there was some missing. We need to get that back. But for me, I feel like just understanding the music game, I'm still always going to be part of the music industry. So I am still a manager. Don't kick me out of the MMF, all right? I'm still part of it. Don't tell Paul. But
just
yeah.
With more focus on the video
side. Yeah, more focus
side.
On the production side and the video the side. But I still am in the music industry, yeah.
But I guess crucially with that is what the MMF is saying is that people like yourselves, when you're advising clients or managing clients, the managers are going to take responsibility for, because this idea that songwriters are always going to agree their splits on the day they write the song and they're going to file the data and they're going to get the ISWCs. When we say songwriters are going to do that, what we actually mean is...
Managers. Will make them.
Managers are going to do that.
You know, and I will say this, I've had experience, example with PRS, when you're uploading the music and you're putting in all the data and that, and you'll go onto it and then... The producer has said 70%. I'm saying, what? When did that happen? So as a manager, you do have to be across everything and you have to really understand what you're doing. And I'm not going to lie, I'm still learning. Like, I've learned a lot from you too, and you, and you, of course. But I've learned a lot even more today. So I think it's something that, because it's always changing, you're always learning. But yeah, I'm definitely going to hit you up because...
Hey. This is interesting because what you talk about being a kind of song, being a manager for a grassroots artist, songwriter, it's really interesting because one of my best friends, her little brother, he's not little, he's like 6'4", but her little brother from Brum,
yeah,
so
okay,
he's super talented, and he has featured on he's an amazing vocalist, and
yeah,
he sings on some really amazing songs and has even been synced into big US shows.
Wow.
He is not a PRS member, and I've tried, but you know what, for him it's actually, he doesn't make any money from his music right now, and those initial fees you have to pay to become a member of these organizations, there's still too much of a hurdle if you're a grassroots creator.
Even like example, I don't want to name drop, but there's a certain distribution company, and I was advising someone the other day, like, you know, you should jump onto this distribution company just to get your music out there, but because they're not making money, to them it doesn't seem like it's worth it to do that small investment. But It is worth it, in my opinion, because I think that I've seen hundreds of thousands of pounds be made on these platforms. But if you're early days and you don't have money like that, you know, and PRS as well, you do have to pay to join. So
pretty much all organisations.
Yeah.
But to your point, Chris, about why this matters to the managers and why they're willing to make their artists and songwriters do this work. I guess it's they're being pragmatic enough to see that they will be the ultimate beneficiaries, I would imagine.
Well, and also I think what I've been told from the MMF is when, because all of this went out to the managers before, because they're saying, you know, actually the first step of this is your commitment. If you don't do this, then none of this is going to work. And I think what a lot of managers said is, we have to agree splits. We have to get all of this into the system. Now, we can do it today, or we could do it in a year's time. We should do it today. And it's sort of like, well, if the system demanded it, because you wouldn't be able to release you. I mean, just to clarify again, this is going to take a long time.
But in the future.
In the future. If you've got to, okay, you cannot release this track until all of this is done, then everybody is going to get it. And sometimes artists and songwriters, they don't like having the conversation, or they're nervous, or maybe they're sneakily thinking, "Oh, if I leave this 6 months, I'll get a bit more money."
And we know some big songwriters do that, right? Yeah. Like really, really famous ones, or producers, or occasionally, like sometimes even managers, occasionally have been known to like string things out because they've got more leverage.
But if you just couldn't do it, then you wouldn't do it, and it's sort of like, you know, well, I mean, you know, anyone who knows me will know that I need a deadline to get anything done.
Don't we all?
And I mean, a lot of the music industry is like, if you do not have an unmovable deadline, unmovable being key, because all deadlines can be pushed back unless they're... The Great Escape for me is a great unmovable deadline. The Great Escape starts when it starts and there's no pushing it back. So if we had this unmovable deadline, which is you cannot release the record until this is done, then the manager's like, yeah, that would be the culture. We would do our bit. And if it meant our songwriters got paid within 2 months of streams... Definitely worth doing. Anyway, we're almost out of time, and there's one more thing that Andy wants to talk about.
Yeah, yes. Let's do our final story.
iPod.
The iPod, yes, because it was announced last week, as the show goes out this week as we're speaking, that Apple was discontinuing the iPod, which means that the 2019 iteration of the iPod Touch will be the last version of the device. This comes as the iPod turns 21 years old.
Oh, God.
Because it was launched in 2001. The original classic iPod was discontinued in 2014. The Shuffle and Nanos both died in 2017. And as it hasn't actually been updated since 2019. But, I mean, it was still there.
I mean, the most recent iPod was basically an iPhone without the phone.
Well, yeah. But so, I mean,
I never owned an iPod.
You know, so I got a story. Like, when iPod came out, that was like, I was probably in, what year did it come out?
2001.
So I was 11. Yeah, I was 11 when it came out. And in school, that was the thing. Like, if you had an iPod, that was like the cool thing to have. I actually didn't have one, but it's fine.
It wasn't fine though, right?
Yeah, it wasn't fine at the time, no, but it's fine now. But for me, the iPod it was like that new, exciting way to listen to music. It was cool. We'd come off LimeWire. So originally it was LimeWire. Yeah, it was LimeWire on the computer and just having to play it on some old speakers. And then now in school, it was about having the iPod, you could listen to music. And I'm not sad about it, but yeah, it was a time period. I forgot your question, sorry.
I just asked if you had owned an iPod.
Oh, yeah, went off on a tangent there. Yeah, no, I didn't. But I know what it was about, but I didn't have one.
I never, did you have an iPod?
Yeah, so I've got a bit of a story. I've always been an early adopter, but when iPods came around, I was poor. Really, really poor. Like, I wanted to adopt, could not afford to.
And it's not like when Apple enter the market with something new, they're going for the economy line market.
No, yeah. It was a very premium product. So when I first could consider buying one, we're still in the first generation of iPods, but I had a PC. The first generation were really Mac compliant, not PC compliant. And I was like, I can't really buy a device that I don't have. I couldn't buy a Mac. Definitely couldn't afford a Mac. So I bought a digital mini disc player, which was not too much cheaper, but it worked with PCs. And so that's what I did when I first bought my first digital device like that. And that was a big mistake. That was redundant within a year. but that's what I did. And then I got...
Minidisc is still the greatest audio format of all time. Just add that.
It was very, very expansive and really, really very useful. And then for my 21st birthday, my girlfriend bought me a pink mini
Aww.
AirPod mini. It was so sweet, my 21st birthday. It got stolen by the postman 3 times. So it turned up about 6 months after my birthday, but like it was really lovely and I still have that because it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Sentimental, exactly. Yes. I mean, it's been, I haven't had a charger that's worked for it for years, but I got the first generation of mini, and then I got a proper iPod 2006. I very generously left a job and my colleagues gave me vouchers so I could buy an iPod with it. Like, I'm one of the big ones, you know. I used it for about 6 months, and then that was when the iPhone became on contract affordable, so you only had to pay like £100 down and then you'd get the second generation iPhone came along, and then I never used my iPod again.
I don't know why I didn't have an iPod, because I must assume, I mean, I downloaded a lot of music and I ripped all my CD collection, but I think I was still just using laptops and PCs with speakers at home. And I must just not have listened to music when I was on the move, which I don't understand because now I do all the time.
Surely, did you not have like a CD player or MP3 something like that? You must have something.
I didn't have a Discman. I can't remember. Anyway, but I never had.
You didn't have a Discman.
I didn't have a Discman. So I'm slightly older than you. As a teenager, I had about 87 very cheap Walkmans. Well, they weren't actually Walkmans, were they? They were whatever the round one. But anyway, it is sort of an end of an era in a way, isn't it? And that the iPhone, almost it feels weird now that why would you have anything other than your phone to listen to music?
It's, you know, nowadays our bank card is our phone. Everything is, you have everything in one. And for someone who literally would lose their head if it was not screwed on, for me, it makes sense just to have everything in one space and everything in one asset, because I can't be bothered to have this and have that. But it is sad. It is sad.
And a few months ago, I can't remember what the project was, I was going back through the CMU archives for something, looking at Spotify stories. And then I found the story from whenever it was that Spotify is coming to the iPhone. And you forget that when Spotify launched, it was a desktop client. And the idea that you couldn't listen to Spotify on your phone.
And it was free though, right? It was when the early Spotify, there wasn't a subscription. It was desktop free. It's excellent.
Yes. But now it's all on the phone. So, but I guess, you know, it is, although nobody really cares because who needs an iPod, it is the end of an era. And I mean, did the iPod save the music industry? I mean, it didn't, it was Spotify's model that really saved the music industry, but maybe it was the iPod that meant that in that period when CD sales crashed, there was certainly iTunes was the download store that captured everyone's imagination.
Yeah, absolutely. It really was, right? Like when I was working, my first days of digital was in 2006. And that, I think Apple had come to the UK in 2005. So I just started music industry. They'd been around for maybe like 9 months at that point. And the money coming in was at that point really quite small. Like it was, you know, hundreds of thousands to a major label a month, but it was doubling month on month. And over the subsequent years, it became digital, all of digital for a while. When I was at EMI in 2011, a la carte was massive at that point. Like it was the biggest digital source of revenue, and everyone reluctantly knew that Spotify would ultimately take over. But like back then, it was. I don't want to say holding the arse up of the industry, but it kind of was. Like we'd been decimated by moving to digital, and Apple and the iTunes Store were the really savior.
It was the thing that made it. The decline stopped, wasn't
yes,
it? And
yeah,
it bottomed
yeah.
out, and then it was Spotify that took it back.
That brought us back to growth. Yeah, it was like it stopped us dying entirely, really.
Yeah.
Revived.
And so really important for the music industry, I guess, but even more important for Apple because, you know, Apple, the biggest company in the world. I mean, I was a proud Apple user in the 90s. It was great being an Apple user in the 90s because you were the underdog. Your technology provider was always on the verge of bankruptcy. Microsoft was evil. And then the iPod came along. Apple became what it is today. And now Apple's evil, isn't it? So all my devices.
Are you allowed to say that?
I think we can say Apple's evil.
You can say what you want.
I think they'd block my devices if I said that. So I'm not saying it.
Yeah, I'm Apple user to the end.
Well, this podcast is available via Apple Podcasts.
For now.
Well, is it?
We'll see what happened.
Samsung takeover, you know.
So I guess, yeah, that brings us to the end of the show. We started with Napster and we ended with the iPod right at the cutting edge.
So we went from 98 to 2002.
No, we went from 98 to 2050 and then back. Yeah, to 2001.
Well, yeah, the end of an era and the end of the show. That's all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. If you want to read more about anything we've discussed on this edition of the show, you find everything in the show notes, which you'll find in your podcast player now. Not now, if you're in the room. Sorry, this is weird. Or at setlistpodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the show, rate the show, review the show. Email us if you want to, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and this week, Chris Cook, Becky Brook, and Amina Badley. And for more on CMU, did I say CMU? I did, yes. I've gone off script. See, this is what I said. Yeah, if I go off script, I lose it.
I think it's completemusicupdate.com is the
website. I believe that's the website, yes. Completemusicupdate.com.
Thank you. Thank
you. Welcome to Setlist. Hello.